Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
Okay, you have a choice. Do you want to hear me talk first about Ron DeSantis or about Tina Turner? I'm going to go with Tina because I've got a lot to say about the botched DeSantis rollout last night and some exclusive information that you will hear here first. Just written a column on it. So, it was 7 minutes to 3 Eastern Time. My phone rings. It's the booker for Martha McCallum show. And she says, Tina Turner just died. Can you phone in? And I said, sure. Somehow, because I guess I'm a member of the rock and roll generation, I've become the go-to person. I mean, I talked to Martha when Christine McVie of Fleetwood Mac died, and there was at least one other that escapes me at the moment. So in that 7 minutes, you know, I went on the Google and just was trying to gather some facts and anecdotes. Nobody had a full obit up, but I managed to find out, for example, that there had been a Broadway musical called Tina just a couple of years ago, that she had won 12 Grammys and, you know, things like that that I could use in the conversation. But mainly I wanted to talk about how she's maybe the most passionate performer I'd ever seen in terms of singing and dancing and, you know, her sheer charisma. You know, anybody who was of a certain age at the time remembers Ike and Tina Turner singing Proud Mary. What an amazing rendition that was. But she also went through a lot of pain, especially because of Ike. She left him because of domestic abuse. And she somehow managed a comeback where she was even greater than she had been as part of this duo. You know, appeared in movies, and she's just an amazing, amazing person. The person who was on before me said that she was the first black female singer to appear on the cover of Rolling Stone, which is kind of amazing. So, you know, we went on for about 5 minutes, you know, and that's the nature of live television. You know, you don't have, sometimes stuff breaks, you don't have a lot of time to prepare, and you say what comes into your head. And Martha also had a lot to say, so we had a good conversation. Let me just throw this in. You know, I felt badly for Kellyanne Conway when she worked in the Trump White House, and her daughter, Claudia, was going on TikTok and ripping her and ripping Trump and all of that. So now, I mean, this is just a write-up in the London Sun. She has a new career. Apparently, her relationship with her mother, the former White House counselor, is much improved. But she's 18 years old, she's gay, 1.6 million followers on TikTok, and she's now announced that she is going to be a model for Playboy. The print magazine doesn't exist anymore. So it's an online platform similar to OnlyFans, but it doesn't mean that there'll be nudity. It'll just probably be a little provocative, but that's the latest on that. Okay, story number one. I was so frustrated last night, as were thousands and thousands of people, trying to get on what's called Twitter Spaces for this innovative, bold launch of Ron DeSantis' campaign with Elon Musk. And it just was a meltdown. The servers crashed. I mean, this was all kind of predictable. And the fact that they couldn't fix it for half an hour, I think speaks to that Musk has laid off a lot of people there. So, you know, he's getting ridiculed by everybody. I mean, Fox News, which had an interview with the governor afterwards, you know, quickly put up a thing saying, you know, if you want to see and hear Ron DeSantis, tune in. Left and right, a lot of mockery, hand-wringing. You only get one chance to make a first impression. You know, what's frustrating was, first of all, you would think it was just you, that everybody else could hear except you. And then you would go on Twitter and realize everybody was going crazy. The voices would come back after maybe 5 or 10 minutes, and you'd hear Musk say, well, you know, let's try to get this thing restarted. And then within 30 seconds, they would vanish again. There were headlines like debacle and disaster. And, you know, if Ron DeSantis goes on to have a pretty successful campaign, nobody will remember this. If not, it will always stand as the metaphor for a botched launch. And, you know, 600,000 people got on there, which I guess is pretty amazing by online standards, but, you know, he could have just gone on TV. Everybody would have seen him. Everybody would have heard him. By the time they brought it back through a live stream, half the audience was gone. Also, just on a normal day, Twitter Spaces is very hard to find. It's not even listed on the homepage. You got to search for it. And there's a lot of steps involved. So I don't understand. The quality is not that great. And why were they doing it audio only? I mean, every bozo podcaster can do a video podcast if he or she wants. Because, you know, the what was supposed to be the genius of it was that it would be replayed. And it was novel. It wasn't DeSantis giving a speech to a rally or, you know, working the crowd at a smaller event. He's not a great orator. And so it's just one of those things that everybody will remember. And again, you know, it won't matter much. Any campaign coverage, if a candidate is perceived as not doing well, and obviously DeSantis has been dropping for a couple of months now, the national polls, and then suddenly the plane gets stuck in the mud and can't take off. You know, the media just suckers for metaphors. It's like, well, you know, if your campaign's going great, then nobody cares that your plane got stuck in the mud. So let me share with you, after the Twitter disaster and after the interview with Trey Gowdy on Fox News, in which, in both instances, there was no mention of Donald Trump. Gowdy sort of alluded to Trump by talking about DeSantis getting these nicknames. He said he didn't really care. But in a conference call late last night with a selected number of journalists that I was on, DeSantis did talk quite openly about Trump in response to questions. And that's why I found it fascinating. He made a little news, by the way, before the call. He said he would fire FBI Chief Chris Wray. He said he would build a border wall. But here's what he said to the journalists on this call. Obviously, Trump would turn out Democrats as the nominee because that's their reflex. Also, I would be shocked if the former president wasn't leading. He has 100% name ID. He's one of the most famous people in the world. How would he reunite the GOP if he does beat Trump? Well, you know, you struggle to come back after primaries. It's not like I'm taking positions that are going to alienate people, but some of the culture war stuff he's doing in Florida, including the 6-week abortion ban, is not going to play well, at least in more liberal states. And then he said, it's early, which of course you would say when you're trailing, at least in national polls. I don't think the average Republican primary voter is obsessing yet, said DeSantis. He said Trump's criticism, some of it at least, is drawing helpful contrasts that benefit him. He said he didn't support an omnibus spending bill that the then president was pushing, that he had added $8 trillion to the debt in the 4 years he was in office. He also attacked me for voting against an amnesty bill that he endorsed, even though there was some funding for a wall. It was a massive amnesty, and DeSantis not liking that at all. Now, I don't know whether DeSantis is going to start going after Trump in more public forums, or at least punch back more than the extent to which he did. But with a hint of frustration, he did say this about recent months when he was totally focused on the Florida legislative session. I didn't have the ability to fight all these battles. I was the number one target of corporate media. And by the way, when the Twitter chat finally did get underway, first of all, Elon Musk and Ron DeSantis were heaping praise on each other. And I don't, you know, with Musk being not only the world's richest man, but one of the most famous, and 140 million Twitter followers. I don't think it's a bad thing that he obviously kind of sort of likes Ron DeSantis. I mean, he didn't do a formal endorsement, but he was just saying how great DeSantis was and how well he had handled the pandemic, even despite, you know, all this media criticism when he tried to reopen Florida while other states remained shut down. And they both took turns bashing the media. You know, the questions were not exactly hard-hitting. And a few other conservative supporters of DeSantis were allowed or called upon to ask questions. So the whole thing was kind of like a love fest. But when DeSantis said, you know, I've been, how did he put it first? Oh, Musk began by saying, there have been a lot of hit pieces on you lately. And DeSantis said, yeah, the media are always in their little bubble. And Musk replied, well, they've gotten pretty hysterical. So they sort of are in tune, certainly on this question of the media, which I think is partially why DeSantis decided to go the Twitter route. And look, he's not to blame for any of the glitches, but he did take a risk. I mean, given the state of Twitter right now, trying to do something like this, he had to know, his people had to know, that it might not work. Now, their spin on it is, well, you know, actually, we broke the internet because we're so popular, and we raised about $1 million during the Twitter session. So it was a big success. Okay, I'm not going to argue with that. Here are some write-ups. Washington Post, Governor Seaman hyped Twitter Spaces as the culmination of his big day, plagued by glitches in the evening. More than glitches. I mean, it was a complete crash. Live chat came to halt after about 20 minutes of mostly silence, while people like me were sitting there going, come on, get it together. Brought about ridicule from DeSantis critics in both parties. DeSantis talked about ending the culture of losing, which is his way of saying Donald Trump led our party to defeat, or at least not a good performance in 2018, 2020, and 2022. Ron DeSantis' botched campaign announcement is another example of why he is just not ready for the job, said a spokeswoman for a pro-Trump super PAC. President Biden shared a video and said, no matter what happens, you can hear Ron DeSantis' agenda loud and clear. Here's Politico. You only get one chance to make a first impression. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis was a glitch. It was meant to be a veritable launch hosted by an actual rocket man. The feed broke, connections got cut off, the host seems confused. It was inauspicious. There's also a black mark on the candidate's supposed trademarks, expert organization, and a comfort with the vanguard of modern media. Conservative radio host Eric Erickson in this Politico piece. It was bold. It turned out to be a mistake. But it's recoverable. It's a reminder that some things should be under the full control of the candidate, particularly the launch day. Governor has been portraying himself in public speeches and private donor meetings as a controlled, low-drama politician, says Politico. On television, Morning Joe, Jennifer Palmieri pronounced it an abomination and just so much hubris all around from DeSantis, from Musk. Joe Scarborough, an embarrassment, the worst of all choices. John Heilman, DeSantis blew it. And then here's a piece, a more substantive piece in the New York Times. Ron DeSantis is girding for battle with Donald Trump where he believes the former president may be most vulnerable on substance. DeSantis is expected to make a series of policy-based arguments, according to his public statements and interviews with people who've met with him privately. He's telling Republicans that unlike the mercurial Trump, he can be trusted to adhere to conservative principles, that Trump is too distractible and undisciplined to deliver conservative policy victories, such as completing his much-hyped border wall. And then any policy promises Trump makes to conservatives are worthless because he's incapable of defeating President Biden. Now, he's going to bring up things like, why did you stick with Anthony Fauci? Allies say DeSantis will try to make the case that Republican voters can trust him to stand his ground on tough issues like abortion. They describe him as an ideologue whose happy place is a quiet room where he can read an academic journal or policy paper. Somewhat socially awkward, he peppers his conversations with references to the Constitution, the Federalist Papers, and Supreme Court case law. And let me just add this. So Rich Lowry, I mentioned yesterday, had this piece in the New York Times, He's Not Dead Yet, which was basically, you know, a defense of a possibly successful DeSantis campaign. But he said DeSantis has to learn to tell a story, that people don't vote for president only on policy. I didn't see much of that yesterday. There was one point, I can't remember now if this was on the conference call or on Twitter, where he said, look, you know, I was a congressman and I was in the military. I mean, stuff a lot of people just don't know. He is very well versed when it comes to all kinds of policies. But, you know, in all honesty, when the Twitter chat resumed, it got really wonky. Got really down in the policy weeds, which is a plus in this way. It shows that he's a governor who knows how to get things done and has strong conservative views on policy. But he didn't have, you know, it got kind of boring after a while. He wasn't telling stories or anecdotes or talking about himself personally much. And, you know, sometimes candidates grow and they get better on the trail. I think DeSantis is going to have to do that, coupled with his discipline and his mastery of policy detail and his accomplishments in Tallahassee. But people want to feel drawn to the person. And look, to really oversimplify it, Donald Trump running mostly on personality, attacks, and, you know, being a strong leader. And Ron DeSantis, at least at this point, running on policy. And I think more is needed.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day, featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
Here's story number two. Politico media writer Jack Schaefer saying, you know, DeSantis hoped to inject a little informality on Twitter into his stiff-necked image. Schaefer sounds like he's not a huge fan. I'm just going to say that right up front. He could make the announcement from inside a kidney-shaped pool filled with wine coolers and still not obscure his straight-jacketed personality, not to mock the governor. Of course, he's going to. He exudes more coldness than coolness. He gives every appearance of not particularly liking people, and that feeling has been reciprocated in the national polls as his numbers have tumbled down. There's the physical straitjacket he dons when he takes the podium or mingles with voters or walks through crowds protected by his ultra-protective retinue. Dead-eyed and door, DeSantis speaks a body language that always seems to be looking for an exit. If no exit exists, he calms his demons by sparking some new senseless fight with the Disney Corporation. If he becomes president, will the House of Mouse rank above or below China in his access of evil? Some more comments from Schaefer. Rigid demeanor, avoidance of the nonpartisan press. Reporters covering DeSantis have gathered these behavioral clues to sow the candidate a straitjacketed image, portraying him as a locked-up, frozen, and vengeful character whose veins pump bile, not blood. And some of this is quite over the top for me. I understand he's got a stiff personality. He doesn't love working rope lines. But this will be difficult for DeSantis to break out of. Like many portraits by the press, this one may not be completely fair. There could be a charming, easygoing lad hibernating under all that permafrost. A Republican Mr. Rogers who wants to be your friend and neighbor. But reporters must rely on what they've seen and heard. He looks and acts like the guy who would confiscate the ball kicked accidentally onto his lawn by kids playing on the sidewalk. Aloof and distant. Tightly wound as a fishing reel. It may be no consolation to DeSantis. The press has reduced him to a political mummy. wrapped tight in the white of his own hang-ups. But that's the way political journalism works. And he gave some historical examples. The candidate makes a face and the press describes it. It's not impossible for him to course correct and share a more human side, to invent a new DeSantis who is relaxed and personable the way Richard Nixon tried to fashion a new Nixon, but the odds are long. Although since he brought up Richard Nixon, who also was socially awkward, the new Nixon managed to win the presidency in 1968 after losing the presidency when he was Ike's vice president in 1960, and then losing a race for California governor in 62, which ended with a press conference in which Nixon said, "You won't have Dick Nixon to kick around anymore," said to the press. He didn't much like the press either, as you may recall from some of what happened during Watergate. Okay, story number three, Donald Trump. Washington Post has a piece saying he's more extreme, more unapologetically extreme, than he was when he ran in 2016 or even in his term as president. Now he talks about January 6th as a beautiful day. He says there was no reason for police to shoot the rioter attempting to break into the House chamber. And he denies any danger to Mike Pence, who was hiding from a pro-Trump mob chanting for him to be hanged. He's promised to pardon many rioters if he becomes president again. On this and a host of subjects, from sexual assault to foreign and domestic policy, Trump's positions have become even more extreme, his tone more confrontational, his accounts less tethered to reality, according to a Washington Post review and interviews with former aides. A return to the White House in Trump's own articulation would be his chance to take revenge on his political opponents and push even further on his most polarizing programs. Now, you know, you instinctively know the Washington Post is not a huge fan of Donald Trump, but there's an attempt here to say whatever he did in the past. I mean, now he's, for example, talking about it was a good idea to split up families at the border, which he used to be more measured in talking about, saying that if you tell them, if you come, the family's going to be split up, they won't come. These are Trump's words. In the storyline Trump presents, he's always the victim, but so are his supporters. The shared experience of suffering through conflicts brings them closer and strengthens their bond, according to NYU historian Ruth Ben-Ghiat. And I think that's why, you know, journalists have been so puzzled for so many years now. He gets indicted. He gets impeached twice. He loses a civil suit to E. Jean Carroll. And he says to his loyal, passionate followers, they're coming after me, they're persecuting me, and that means they're coming after you, they're persecuting you. It's all prosecutorial misconduct. When they go after me, it's literally, quote, they're going after you. This was at a rally in Waco. Together, we're taking on some of the most menacing forces and vicious opponents our people have ever seen. But no matter how hateful and corrupt the communists and criminals we're fighting against may be, you must never forget, this nation does not belong to them. This nation belongs to you. So he has become just an absolute master of telling his most passionate supporters that when he gets knocked down, it's really aimed at them. When he gets investigated, then it's always by unfair prosecutors, unfair judges. They are under attack as well. There's an interview here with John Kelly, the retired general, Trump's former second chief of staff, saying all those people tried to overturn the election. That's exactly what he wanted them to do. He can't be turning his back on people who tried to save him in the election. There's no compass. What is right today is not necessarily right tomorrow, Kelly says. What's right this morning may change four times before this evening. It all depends on who he's talking to and what he's trying to accomplish in that moment. It sounds very much like Kelly speaks from experience in terms of Trump constantly changing his mind and who he talks to and so forth. But I think to get John Kelly on the record, even though obviously he had a difficult parting with his former boss in the White House, strengthens the peace. As opposed to, you know, sources say he's going to get revenge and all that stuff. Story four. I would be sick of, and you're probably sick of, the endless and endlessly covered debt ceiling showdown talks, except this has gone on for months. Today is May 25th. Janet Yellen says June 1st is the deadline when the government won't be able to pay its bills. And just day after day, I mean, they're meeting and then they're putting meetings on pause. Both President Biden and Kevin McCarthy say they will not be a default. And look, they could end this thing in the next 5 minutes. They could just do a stopgap for 6 months, whatever. But really, I think it's starting to rattle the markets. And even before we get to the date where the government will have great difficulty paying its bills, there's a real-world impact. And this has happened before with these threatened government showdowns. And they just seem hung up. They seem like they're trying to compromise. But keep in mind, Kevin McCarthy has a 4-vote margin in the House. 4 or 5 votes. And if he compromises too much with the Democrats, he loses some of his most conservative members, and they won't vote for this package. President Biden has a 1-vote margin in the Senate, and which is letting House Democrats take the lead because that's where the action is right now. And if Biden compromises too much on spending cuts, he loses some of his progressive members. If that happens, then either McCarthy would need to pick up some Democratic votes from Democratic centrists who just think it's sensible not to be flirting with default, or Biden would have to pick up a few Republican votes from centrists who are worrying that they would get killed in next year's election if this happened. So McCarthy yesterday, this is during a meeting on Tuesday morning, told his people, don't break ranks over the debt ceiling crisis. I put crisis in quotes because it's a totally manufactured crisis. McCarthy told Republicans they have the upper hand and encouraged his members to show their support of colleagues facing tough re-election bids, according to a couple people who were in that private meeting. McCarthy urged members to make sure vulnerable lawmakers would have plenty of campaign money from GOP coffers. Meanwhile, the GOP is trying to stay unified behind the bill that it passed. A White House is suddenly eager to compromise. And some Democrats are pushing a petition. It's called a discharge petition, where you can force a vote whether Kevin McCarthy likes it or not. The problem is, they are in the minority in the House, and they would have to win a handful of Republican votes in order to, the discharge petition would allow them to proceed with a vote. Now, House Republicans are doing some compromising, agreeing to drop some provisions in the bill they passed, especially a call for Biden to abandon his student loan forgiveness program, which they have no need to do because the courts have stalled it, and I don't think it's going to ever see the light of day thanks to the courts. And to cancel some green energy tax credits. But they're also determined to push for more concessions that weren't in their original bill. First of all, they've ruled out Biden's proposals to close tax loopholes. That's always a non-starter with the GOP. And they want to increase spending. Remember, they're like, oh, the federal government spends too much on the military, homeland security, and veterans services while cutting funds with domestic programs. So it's not about how much you spend, it's what you spend it on, which is the classic Democratic-Republican divide, as long as I've been alive. The RNC chairwoman, Ronna McDaniel, on Fox News, said the vast majority of Americans feel like you're not headed in the right track. Then you look at the debt ceiling crisis, you look at us about to a default, and you see the president took 90 days out from negotiating. Kind of a fair point. He refused to come to the table with Republicans. Republicans have a plan on the table. This is an MIA president when it comes to the problems the American people are facing. This is a president who's failing the American people. Here's Marjorie Taylor Greene downplaying the whole thing, saying regular Americans don't worry about things like that. She was on Steve Bannon's podcast, and she said, And Bannon asked, has Janet Yellen come forward and shown you a business person, as a business person, any set of math? No, she's over there with the smoking mirrors, or smoke and mirrors. Seriously, it's such a joke, says MTG. And let's be real, guess what? This is something every taxpayer knows. This government here, they take in money every day, Steve. There's plenty of cash. It comes flooding in every day. And what do they do over there at the Treasury? They just keep printing more money. Well, here's the problem with that. The problem with that is this money has already been spent. The government has already borrowed it, and now the bill has come due. And when Marjorie Taylor Greene says, you know, most average Americans don't care about this, well, they may not even care about a government shutdown, but they will care when Social Security checks aren't being sent out, when national parks are closing. We have been through government shutdowns. It is true, it is the incumbent president usually bears responsibility. We'll see whether Biden is able to flip that. And of course, this is all focused on a relatively small part of the budget. 70% of the budget, which neither party is pushing to touch, is Medicare and Social Security. Those are the entitlement programs. Touching them is considered to be touching the third rail of politics. And you can understand why. But what we're seeing here is, and you can decide who you want to blame, just a complete inability to compromise, even though they keep coming out and saying, oh, we've made progress, but we're still far apart. So with us heading into the final days, and maybe the administration comes up with some gimmick to come up to delay doomsday, that's where we stand.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
Okay, number five. With the huge controversy over the payments to Clarence Thomas for vacations, real estate, you name it, by his billionaire pal and GOP donor, Harlan Crow. And I mentioned yesterday or the day before what a fair piece The Atlantic did. Graham Woods sitting down and saying, no, he's not a Nazi, even though he collects Nazi memorabilia, but he also collects memorabilia from Cesar Chavez and others. That giving him plenty of time to respond to questions about why he's giving this money to Clarence Thomas. Does it create the appearance of a conflict? But then Harlan Crow came out and said he wasn't going to cooperate with a government inquiry into this. So he has gotten his message out through the pages of The Atlantic, but he doesn't want to be part of what he probably views as the circus. So Chief Justice John Roberts, this is the reason for this update, broke his silence in comments to CNN about the whole ethics controversy swirling around Clarence Thomas accepting lavish trips and gifts from a GOP mega donor during a speech indicating the court would enact new ethics reforms. The first time he's really even addressed this. And I think he's let it go on too long. So here's what Robert said. And on a final issue of concern inside the court, I want to assure people, I am committed to making certain we as a court adhere to the highest standards of conduct. We are continuing to look at things we can do to give practical effect to that commitment. And I am confident there are ways to do that are consistent with our status as an independent branch of government under the Constitution's separation of powers. And the CNN reporter then said to him, look, there are polls showing that 41% of Americans approve of what the court is doing, 59% disapprove. So in parsing this, sure, Roberts is sending a signal, but he doesn't even use the word ethics. It's incredibly vague. I didn't expect him to call out Clarence Thomas, but it just seems like a politician trying to quell a furor by saying, oh, you know, we're aware of this, we're looking at this, but not making any commitments on any specifics whatsoever. If you're going to do this, I think it should have been a little sharper. I understand the whole independent branch of government thing, that SCOTUS doesn't want Congress telling it what to do, and indeed that would be unconstitutional. So I'm glad that Roberts kind of sort of addressed it, but I think he could have gone a little further. And we'll see what they come up with. Is it going to be just some sort of boilerplate rule? It doesn't really affect anything. Remember, the issue at stake here is not as so much Clarence Thomas, whatever you think of this whole thing, getting this money from a longtime friend, but not disclosing it on federal forms. And so I don't even know why it took John Roberts so long to weigh in here. And unfortunately, and I look, this is a guy who brokered a lot of compromises before there was a 6-3 supermajority, including same-sex marriage and so forth, and he's a serious jurist. But on this issue, I think he's kind of fallen short. But we shall see. Thank you so much for spending time with me on all of these things, whether it's Tina Turner or Ron DeSantis or the Elon Musk debacle or disaster. There'll be a lot more now that DeSantis is officially a candidate. Probably be more fun to cover. I'm sure Trump is getting ready to push back hard, as well as just mocking him over the botched Twitter rollout. Hope you subscribe to this podcast if you're not always getting it automatically on your phone and in your inbox. And we'll be back tomorrow with more BuzzMeter.
Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts and via Apple Podcasts, and Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.